Fora TV, the world is thinking.
For folks who just came in, please shut off your cell phone and pagers as a courtesy. Well, tonight we are so thrilled to have with us the great political analyst and observer, Michael Parente, to talk about his 21st book, Contrary Notions. He has written so extensively on so many topics: history, politics, gender, ethnicity, the list goes on and on. Before I forget, he has a website, and please go to it for more information. His website is michaelparente.org. O-R-G. Well, without further ado, here is Michael to talk about his latest analysis.
Well, thank you. This book is, as you know, it's a reader. It's an anthology of a collection of my stuff. So I don't really know what to talk about in it. It's just too much. There's stuff on... I'm going to do the infomercial first. There's stuff on media, on epistemology, question of objectivity in the dominant paradigm. There's stuff on elections, about the stolen presidential elections. I had this article on how the free market killed New Orleans, because that was made such a splash on the net when I sent it out, and it was translated, and people got really leaped on it. So I put that in the book. And there's other different subjects here, lifestyle questions. One article I did that people really like, so I put it in here too, is called Are Heterosexuals Worthy of Marriage? And it describes what heterosexuals have done to marriage, you know? I mean, it's horrible. It's a horrible story. And then I have a few personal pieces, reminiscent about the old neighborhood. You got to have that. And then there's a whole section on concepts and isms, and another one on money, class, and culture. And then there's a whole section with selections about foreign policy. One is called Imperialism for Beginners. That gets visited so often, I thought I should put that in. And something on Yugoslavia and Venezuela, Iraq, and an article called The Free Market Paradise Liberates Communist Europe. And then the last section is called The Rest is History, and that's what the rest is history, and et cetera. So it's quite a range of stuff, and I didn't even tell you all the particular subjects in those subsections. So what I thought I would talk about is something that's related. I will want to read a few little selections from the book. There are authors, you know, who, when you say he's going to do a book signing and a reading, they take that literally, and they read, and they read, and they read. I think the fiction writers are sometimes the worst. You know, they say, I'm just going to read chapter 3. You know how long chapter 3 is? And they read the whole chapter. I will, though, read a few relatively short selections of my deathless prose. What I want to talk about is, and it's a theme that runs through some of these writings and other things, and that's the question of how do we look at political reality? Because that seems to be something that's really important, and it's neglected in a way. There's a big tendency to see the world as a world beset by folly. It's a world, it's a world beset by confusion and stupidities, we hear. Are we not on a darkling plain swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight while ignorant armies clash by night? It's beautiful poetry. It's one of my favorite poems. But Matthew Arnold, I think, is wrong. These armies aren't so ignorant. they're not so confused. And that's the theme of my remarks. I want to argue that stupidity and confusion are not king. By having this habit that we have of repeatedly seeing the furious activities of the class warriors, that is, the top decision makers who I consider to be class warriors, you're seeing them as stupid, then we can only make a limited critique of their policies without addressing the class war that they're waging. Their policies become the product of their personal shortcomings. If you say George Bush is stupid, he does this because he's stupid, he does that because he's stupid, then that's the end of your critique. He does these things only because he's not as smart as all of us. And it's very easy for us to rock back on our heels and talk about how stupid U.S. foreign policy is, how stupid this or that president is, and the like. To see them as stupid is to elevate peripheral and marginal features of leadership to a central role, to give it centrality. I mean, what are the signs of stupidity? Generally, it's linguistic inabilities, linguistic mistakes that they make, you know. More children's are doing this. You know, he has a problem with the language. Yes, he's probably a little dyslexic. And these linguistic difficulties are treated as mental deficiencies and as explanatory of policy errors. Well, I want to argue also that these policies are not errors. There are three presidents I can recall who were especially linguistically challenged. That was Eisenhower, Reagan, and Bush Jr., whom we have today. Eisenhower was also informationally challenged. He didn't hold a lot of information together. That wasn't true of Reagan or Bush Jr. They could come back and they could make a polemical point out of almost everything. They could put a spin. You listen to Bush, and he is a spin artist on any number of issues. And so was Reagan, polemically adept. I'll tell you who's stupid. We are stupid when we think that those who own most of the world, who wield such power over our lives and communities, over private wealth and public office, are stupid. When you think they're stupid, you're being stupid. Okay? The stupidity defense, by the way, was very opportunistically used by the objects of our scoffing and scorn on a number of occasions, these presidential power wielders. They used stupidity as a way of distancing themselves from the skullduggery they indulge in when they get caught. I'm thinking of Reagan with the Iran-Contra investigation. Do you know, his defense was just that everybody had been saying about him, saying, you know, I've got to be more hands-on in my administrative. I kind of let things slip, and I'm not too quick on the pickup sometimes and all that. In other words, he didn't have anything to do with it. He was lax. He was negligent. He was kept in the dark about the whole messy Iran-Contra scandal. It was only later determined that he knew about the whole messy operation. Of course he did. Of course he okayed it. You think Poindexter would have hatched that whole colossal plot? You think Ollie North would have done it? They were the ones who had to take the fall. But it came out later that of course he gave the okay. They couldn't have done it unless the president would give the okay. But that wasn't the idea that we had. We had an idea. Oh, it's the people behind him. Oh, it's always the people. Then who made this decision? I remember at one point they had Weinberger before the Senate committee, and they said, "Well, who was Secretary of State under Reagan? Schultz." He says, "Well, if Schultz didn't make the decision, and you didn't make the decision, who did?" And Weinberger said,
Well, who do you think did? The president, for Christ's sake. Why has it always got to be somebody, some mysterious person behind him? It was the president who made the decision about some particular thing. It wasn't about the whole green light on Iran-Contra. So there you have it. Bush Jr. has done the same thing. He talked about the mistaken intelligence briefings regarding certain things about Iraq and the stuff in Africa, remember, in Niger and all that. The CIA was stupid. And he was stupidly, innocently misled. And if you believe that, I have some oceanfront property in Nebraska that I want to sell you. And yet it's the most common and continually, like parrots, we just keep repeating these things. We hear other people say it, we internalize it, and it becomes our opinion, and then we repeat it. Stop doing that. Stop repeating what you hear on the air, and even what you hear from some of your friends. Listen to me. Two more dramatic examples of a nefarious agenda masquerading as incompetence involving Bush Jr. One of them is Katrina. It was not mismanagement in New Orleans. Decisions were consistently ruthless. Resources were consistently withheld. Medical aid, rescue teams, and food poured in from all over the nation were consistently turned away and put in storage while people were suffering terribly, while the doctors in the arenas were saying, we need help, we need assistance. More concern was given to crowd control and looters than to public safety and rescue operations. People died who could have easily been rescued. There was a war done against that community. And it was taken immediately by the bloggers. It was taken as proof that government doesn't work, you see? Private charity does. Well, here I'll read one little excerpt from that thing on who killed New Orleans. I said, to be sure, government does not work. Certainly not when it's in the hands of reactionaries who have no desire to see it work. New Orleans was victimized by those right-wing ideologues who oppose the idea that government can be a salutary force in regard to social needs and human services. The White House reactionaries would be quite content to demonstrate that government is not to be counted on when it comes to helping communities, especially low-income and ethnic minority communities that are Democratic strongholds. By the way, that Democratic bloc of New Orleans, which often carried the state of New Orleans for Democratic statewide candidates, has been shattered to a substantial degree. Well, 9/11, on 9/11, I don't want to go, of course, 9/11, the 9/11 issue is endless, but let me just say that I saw George Bush on TV, and I can't for the life of me find the clip. I don't remember exactly when. I wish I could find it. I wanted to write something on it, where I heard him say, yes, he was told that there would be a terrorist attack pending, but they didn't tell him when, where, how, or who. And I thought, well, first of all, when you hear that, you say, excuse me, are you president of the United States? You can't be bothered unless somebody comes with the spoon and puts it right in your mouth. There aren't things that you can do, like you can't alert the airports, which he never did. You can't alert the airlines, which he never did. You can't alert your own security forces, which he never did. And in any case, various intelligence reports, including the famous August 6 one from the CIA, but from other foreign intelligence services, France, England, Israel, and Morocco was especially interesting because they had actually infiltrated al-Qaeda. They repeatedly told him exactly the answers to those. They told him when. They said very soon. They told him where. A big city, probably New York. They told him how. It most likely would be a hijacked airliner being used as a weapon, flying it into a building. And they told him whom? Al-Qaeda. Well, that's about as specific as you can hope to get under those circumstances and all. In doing nothing to thwart the attack, was Bush incompetent? Or was he and his coterie doing their best to clear the way for another Pearl Harbor, or Bay of Tonkin, or Battleship Maine? Actually, Bay of Tonkin is not a good analogy. Pearl Harbor is really the analogy, which a large loss of American life, a major attack right on American territory and the like. Such an attack would provide the casus belli for massive military involvements that the U.S. public would otherwise not go along with. Oh, Parenti, what do you have, a conspiracy theory? There's the parrots. That's the parrot reaction again. Boop, it presses the button. Oh, conspiracy theory, a conspiracy theory. Yeah, you have a conspiracy theory? Say, no, bird, I wring your little neck. Those aren't my words. Those are words that were said by Bush's own coterie, by his own advisors. I'll repeat them again. That is providing a casus belli for massive military involvements that the U.S. public would otherwise not go along with. It has to be an incident of the magnitude of Pearl Harbor. And I got the secret conspiracy place where you can find that document. It's right on the goddamn internet. It's called Project for New American Century, and it's their statement called Rebuilding America's Defenses. They say that right in there. That's what they would need. And that's what they got. What a coincidence. Well, so 9/11 was a godsend, and it served to turn the entire nation to war out of fear for its security and survival. And whether or not And Project for New American Century, the personnel were Dick Cheney, Paul Wolfowitz, Douglas Feith, Donald Rumsfeld. These were the guys who put this thing together. And they were now in the White House waiting for it to happen. Now, if it was not something that they themselves perpetrated, it certainly was something they knew was coming, and they looked the other way and welcomed it to happen because it opened up everything that's been happening ever since. Now, if leaders are not innocently trapped in their incompetence, there's another subdiscipline. It's called political psychology, and there's an element within that subdiscipline of political psychology who concentrate on leaders, and they always show how these leaders are trapped by their own psychological makeup. And the investigator, being so much more intelligent than the leader, shows how this leader was bothered and troubled by all these problems. Psychologizing leadership behavior is a way of denying the political economic interests that are at play. Presuming to be able to explain policy decisions and policy behavior by reducing the policy motives to factors of personality obliterates a certain huge chunk of political and economic reality. We hear that Bush is really a dry drunk. He suffers from rejection from his father, or he wants to outdo his father and go further in Iraq than his father did, and all this other stuff, and he's really a psychotic and so forth, blah, 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 and all that. Well, the truth is that there have been presidents of the United States over the last 200 years of completely different personalities, completely different personal histories, completely different families and childhoods and regions and eras and times and epochs, completely different positions in their sibling rotation or ranking. Some were firstborn, some had three older sisters, some had, two brothers, whatever. different in their psychological proclivities, yet they all pursued policies that were consistent with the needs and goals of U.S. finance capital. They all did. They all did some of the same things. They pursued policies that have been rather consistently expansionist, aggressive, violent, and I would add, successful. Once it's decided, that's why I can't put too much on personal psychology. You know, you can get two guys of different personal psychologies and they're doing the same thing. Different political parties and they're doing the same thing. Once it's decided that these decision makers are stupid, ill-informed, incompetent, or now neurotic, it follows that their policies are failures. Bush is described as a failed administration, right? We're hearing that all the time. Now, are you going to repeat that phrase because you've heard someone else say it? Or are you going to say, what failure? You're going to repeat my phrase. What failure? You're going to say, what wrong turns? The estate tax has been eliminated. Corporate taxes have been cut back to almost nothing. Billions in Medicare are being handed over to the big pharmaceutical companies. We had no choice on this. Military budget has doubled. Record profits for the defense industry. Record corporate profits. Human services have been cut back or held flat. All the great society programs are pretty much gutted and defunded. Wages remain flat or have declined. Two presidential elections have been stolen. Read the book. It's in there, a chapter on that. The super rich are richer than ever. You tell me where the failure is. When George Bush came into office, oil was $20 a barrel. 7 years later, oil is $100 a barrel. Is that a failure or a success? Well, it depends on what side of the gas pump you're standing, isn't it? For us, it's a failure of an administration. Something's really wrong. For the guys who run the oil companies, it's heaven. It's paradise. Even in the area of foreign policy, there have been setbacks, it's true, but much success. U.S. military power has established a presence in the Middle East and in a place it has almost never been before in its entire history, with major permanent bases in Central Asia, in countries which most Americans don't even know exist and whose names they can't pronounce, large permanent military bases. Iraq has been good to very good to about 100 U.S. corporations in billions of dollars in contracts at a level of profit that's the hottest thing going in the last 4 years. The hottest area of investment has been getting in on the Iraq gravy. One-third of the Pentagon budget for Iraq is unaccounted for. The Pentagon admits at least one-third. It may be even more. Again, that's a failure as far as administering for the public interest and the commonweal. But it's a smashing success if you're on the take and you're in there scooping up the gravy. Free trade is going into its final phase and is destroying local markets and production. It's wiping out the entire Mexican peasant class. That's why we're getting so many of these people wanting to come. You think they just so love to freeze their butts off in the Bay Area? And Mexico's a wonderful place. They often have no choice, and it's got the pressure for immigration to go and try and find a living is getting more and more desperate. Free trade is... is extending corporate control over every corner of the Earth's remaining resources. Free trade elevates the right to property above all other rights that exist, including national sovereignties to defend democratic rights. Another thing I would ask you to look for is contextualization. What we often get is the absence of contextualization. That is, fitting the particular action or condition or policy in a broader set of social relations. Contextualization has two dimensions. First, the action or condition or policy or conflict or social problem, whatever it is, can be linked and should be linked to the social structure itself, to other issues and interests other than just the immediate one. Second, the action or issue or problem should be linked to past history when relevant. And this can be very revealing. Usually, a way of not telling the story is by blanking out the previous history. Let me give you an example of that, which has been consistently observed by every policymaker, every major mainstream politician, and all the mainstream media. Let me give you this example again and again and again, like a magical black hole. The U.S.'s relationship to Saddam Hussein. What's never mentioned is that relationship and how it began somewhere after 1958. What's never mentioned is that Iraq, the whole history of Iraq, having a democratic revolution in 1958 in which they kicked out the British and American oil companies and took it over and formulated a democratic government. We never hear that because what we hear is this Colonel Blimp imperialist view, which is the U.S. has to go in there among these backwood peoples, darker complexion peoples, and we have to uplift them and teach them democracy. Give the Iraqis the opportunity for democracy. Well, they had a democracy. And who was the U.S. backing in those days? I'll tell you who it backed. It backed a reactionary, murderous Ba'athist officer named Saddam Hussein. His first gig was with the CIA, and it was to assassinate the democratically elected prime minister, a job which he bungled. He wounded him, and they hurried him out and set him up somewhere else. I forget where they brought him to some safe place in Qatar or wherever. Saddam Hussein was their guy, and they backed him, and they financed him, and they got his death squads and hit squads together, and he went out there, and he murdered every communist, every progressive, every constitutionalist, every Democrat, murdered or drove them underground or into exile. And he took over that country. He then also murdered the whole left wing of the Ba'athist Party itself. That's a history. When have you heard that in the last 5 years? When on CBS, NBC, ABC, or Fox Network did you hear that? Did I mispronounce that last one? I didn't. He says I didn't mispronounce it. When did you hear that? Well, so when Saddam Hussein was at his most murderous and most torturous, that's when he was Washington's poster boy. It was only later when he got out of line, he refused to privatize the economy, he started committing economic nationalism. He didn't throw it open and say, come on in back, boys, like a good comprador leader would, and say, here it is, it's all yours, the oil is yours, and all that. It's when he didn't do that, when they realized, this guy's running his own show. We did all this, what, for him to have autonomy here? Then suddenly we started hearing Saddam, and then he got out of line on the oil quotas, remember, in 91, when everybody was worried about oil prices in those days. I got that in one of my books, maybe in this one, I forget now, but where I even quote, I think it was from the New York Times or Washington Post, said, worried about Iraqi oil on the market, the price of oil might collapse. They were keeping it off, and he was saying, this is economic aggression. This is a disaster for Iraq if we can't sell our oil. And that was the first Gulf War. That old history, never mentioned. for 4 or 5 years. It begins like there was no history. Like he just dropped from the sky, and there he is, and we start talking about, what a dictator he is. Yeah, suddenly discovered that he's a dictator, which he definitely was, and we have to get rid of him, so forth. So that's a good example of decontextualizing, you see. You take the thing out and you just treat it in isolation, and then you can play any spin on it you want. You're not encumbered by the realities of its own history. Decontextualizing is a subtler form of obliterating considerations of intent and interest. It constricts the universe of discourse. It suppresses a lot of what needs to be said. Take, for instance, the debate about the Vietnam War. I was speaking at the College of Southern Nevada last month, and a student asked me, how would you compare the protests on the Vietnam War? And I don't know if she said protest or... Well, the debate about the Vietnam War and the debate about the Iraq War. And I said, well, one striking similarity between the two, for all their other historical differences, one remarkable similarity is that the debate on both of those wars has been constricted and conflated. It's been limited to a debate between those who say we can win this war and those who say we cannot. That's the whole debate. Those of us who say we should never even have been in this war, whether we could win it or lose it, and what does winning it mean, and it's a war of aggression, and there shouldn't be such a war, those people are not allowed in the debate. And if the debate really is, if you're really debating that you're against the war because it cannot be won, you really are supporting that war. Because if your whole opposition to that war is purely an instrumental or operational opposition based on operational grounds only, that it's not working, implicitly you're assuming the same things as the aggressors. All your complaint is the aggression isn't successful enough, and so therefore I part. So in other words, I share those presumptions. I assume that the war, that the U.S. can and has the right to wage aggression and bomb people and violate international law, just as long as they're successful at it and it's a relatively quick and easy victory. And that's a false presumption. Well, there you go, Parenti. You just said false presumption. So our leaders do have false presumptions. They do have confusions. They do have mistaken notions. Well, yes, no one is infallible or omniscient. Mistakes are made. For instance, the anticipation that the Iraqis would welcome us with flowers and all that and embrace us. If they really believed that image, I don't know. But, right, they didn't expect to still be fighting 4 years later. Bush landed on the aircraft carrier, remember, in that flight jacket suit and announced that mission accomplished and all that. But more often, the false presumption is a deception and not a mistake. They say things that are confusing, not because they are confused, but because they want to create confusion in your mind. Just because they say misleading things, just because they say things that are intended to mislead you, doesn't mean that they themselves are misled. So what I would be saying is that much of politics is the rational manipulation of irrational symbols. I'm going to wind it down. Am I going too long so far? Is this all right? Okay. Let me give you fascism as a prime example, and I do have a chapter in the book. I do have a chapter in the book. A selection in the book on fascism. I think I call it fascism: the untold story. Now, what the hell could be the untold story about fascism? Well, It's a prime example of the slighting of political economic content. You can read 100 biographies of Hitler, and you almost never find out what the hell he did when he went into office. I mean, aside from his atrocities, the suppression, the aggression, the Anschluss of Austria, the taking of Czechoslovakia, all that stuff, and the politics of getting there and who supported him and all that. What you don't hear is who did he support once he got in? The focus is on the political machinations, the appeals to mass psychology, the leadership cult, the atavistic ideology of Nazism with all its various symbols and obscurantist meta-theories, the totalitarian power, the militarization. I said leadership cult, didn't I? The leadership, I'll say it again, the suppression of democratic opposition. What's left out is the political economy. What did the Nazis do when they got into office in Germany? They did the same thing that the Italian fascisti did when they got into office, They took over, they grabbed state power. In Italy, did the same thing. They cut taxes for the rich. They increased corporate subsidies and corporate profits. They destroyed the labor unions. They increased armaments allocations and spending. They pursued wars of aggression. They privatized the public sector. By the way, does any of that sound... So the goal, whether it's called democratic capitalism of a reactionary order or fascism, whatever, all the variations in between. The goal is to maintain that existing class structure and that existing system of expropriation and accumulation of surplus value. One last thing I want to mention is objectivity. So what I'm talking about here is not so much the what, but how to think about some of these things. Objectivity does not mean neutrality. You can have an intense interest in a subject, if you have an intense interest and involvement in a subject, you might want to write your article, a book, or dissertation about that subject. That's true of most articles and books. It's not true of most dissertations. Generally, graduate students in political science and other fields like that are directed to subjects that they're not interested in, and their mentors, their teachers, their professors aren't interested in, and nobody's interested in. And that's called academic scholarship and objectivity, you see. And that if you're interested and excited about the subject, and you're involved in it, well, then this might mean that you can't maintain your scholarly objectivity. And the reason some academics are boring is because they themselves are bored with the subject they're studying. I mean, how the hell do you expect me to get excited about it if you're not excited about it? Why would I be interested in it if you just drone on about it? Well, you don't achieve neutrality. In other words, you don't achieve neutrality by neutralizing your subject matter. And that is often what happens, especially in political science scholarship, that is, wanting to show yourself neutral, you neutralize your subject matter. But politics is about the furies of private interests. The furies, capital F, Marx wrote that, meaning the Greek furies he was talking about, the furies of private interest. When you get into this, you get into a whirlwind. You get into things that involve people killing other people, people lying, people doing every sort of machination. This is what you're going to be studying. But you start studying these kind of hot subjects, it splashes off on you. How measured and scholarly can you really be if you're studying this? So the idea is to pick a safe subject, one that's neutralized. By neutralizing your subject, you are supposedly neutralizing yourself and showing yourself to be objective, you see. Don't get caught in the partisan passions of political struggle. Dilute it and emerge unscathed on your road to tenure. This is not just in politics. You know, there's all sorts of fields like this. In psychoanalytic literature, I remember reading a psychoanalytic journal. The psychoanalyst was writing a case study. He wanted to say the patient had sexual desires, right? That's what he wanted to say. He said the client, I wrote it here, the client cathected his affects onto libidinous objects. The sentence did not turn me on at all. What do we have there? We don't have science there. We have the scientistic pretense. That's what we have. And a dilution of the subject matter. Okay, I'm going to end it here by saying my last admonition is that we should learn to ask why. We should understand that human struggle and human behavior is purposive. That things just don't happen. That people just aren't just meandering around absent-mindedly. That they have goals and targets and they can be very ruthless about it. And when we understand those things, then we move from a liberal complaint to a radical analysis. We must learn to move beyond the parameters of safe and acceptable discourse. And let me close this with a brief reading of one page in the book. Social problems are rarely associated with the political economic forces that create them. That is, they're rarely associated by media people, policymakers, politicians, and even a lot of social commentators. We're taught to rein in our own critical thinking and not ask why things happen the way they do. By the way, you know, that wonderful guy and really good media critic, Norman Solomon, did a movie called War Made Easy, and I saw it at Grand Lake, the theater. And one of the people who was involved in the production, she got up beforehand and she said, we've got to learn to say why, to ask why, to ask why. Be like a persistent four-year-old. Why is this happening? Why? Then they showed the movie. And I must say, the movie never asked why. The whole movie showed president after president committing these acts of war and aggression. And you're left to say, well, we keep electing these sociopaths who just go out and like to bomb countries and attack countries. Why do they do that? So here were people who are saying, we've got to ask why, and yet the movie, I'm going to talk to Norman about it, if he'll still talk to me after I say this, but that's the kind of problem we have. Why? Stop. It's not enough to denounce this as terrible. Can you please explain? Here's a social phenomenon. What are the things that produced this phenomenon? Imagine if we attempted something different. Supposing we report that there are harsh labor conditions existing in a country. That itself is kind of a radical thing to say. There are harsh labor conditions. But then supposing we go a step further and we say that these conditions exist and they have the backing of the military in those countries. Well, there's another why. Because if you say, why are there these conditions? Well, the military imposes them and stops any attempts at unionizing or bettering or strife. Okay, how do you like that? Sometimes you might hear that. And then what you don't hear is, well, why? Why would the military do that? Is it just these guys in uniform get mean and they hate their own people in their own country? Suppose further we cross another line and we note that these military forces are fully supported and funded by the U.S. national security state. Oh, how do you like that? Why does the U.S. keep supporting these terrible people? Why don't they get wise and get with the people who are... I mean, I heard that for 50 years. Why do you think? We know why, because they're not as smart as you. Or maybe there's another explanation. Maybe you're missing something from it. Maybe it's because they have no interest in supporting these labor unions. Their interests lie other ways. Okay, back to the reading. Then suppose we cross that most serious line of all, and instead of just deploring this fact that the U.S. military supports these repressive U.S. supports these repressive militaries, instead of just deploring this fact, we also ask why successive U.S. administrations have involved themselves in such pursuits throughout the world. Supposing we conclude that the whole phenomenon is consistent with a dedication to making the world safe for free market corporate capitalism, as measured by the kinds of countries that are helped and the kinds that are attacked. Such an analysis almost certainly would receive no circulation save in a few select radical publications. We crossed too many lines, going beyond the parameters of permissible discourse in this great country of free enterprise, free expression and free speech. That's not in the line. I injected that. Back to this author. God, he reads so well. What's his name? Okay. We cross too many lines, going beyond the parameters of permissible discourse, because we try to explain the particular situation, bad labor conditions, in terms of a larger set of social relations, transnational corporate power. Our presentation would be rejected out of hand as conspiracy theory, or Marxist, or paranoid, or cynical, or some other negative label that puts a foreclosure on critical thinking and evidence. In sum, the news media's daily performance, this passage is about the news media, but we could add, I've been talking about policymakers. Let me dress it up. In sum, the news media's daily performance and the performance of policymakers, political leaders, opinion leaders, and other political observers under what is called democratic capitalism is not a failure, but a successfully evasive success. We often hear that the press got it wrong or dropped the ball on this or that story. In fact, the media do their job quite well. Media people have a trained incapacity for the whole truth. They have a trained incapacity not to cross too many lines if they want to stay in the profession. Once we grasp this, we move from a liberal complaint about the press or the policymakers' sloppy performance to a radical analysis of how journalists and editors maintain the dominant paradigm with much craft and often with the utmost sincerity, having internalized the notions and images of the prevailing orthodoxy. And by the way, and that confluence of self-censorship and internal notions is what passes for objectivity. We might recall Upton Sinclair's remark, "It is difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends upon his not understanding it." Thank you, ladies and gentlemen, for your kind attention. Maybe a few questions we can do. All right. Well, a few questions would we like? Yes, Jennifer, you wanted to. Jennifer wants to make an announcement about the best politician we have statewide in California today, Deborah Bowen. Go ahead. Quick, though, quick, yeah.
That if you've read Invented Reality, you know it's owned by the same people who own the voting machines. Please write letters to the editor, respond to articles online, and call talk radio shows and blog, and call the local officials, saying that accuracy of the vote is more important to you than the speed at which you receive the answer that Diebold wants to make one. So please just support Dr. Bowen and her efforts against voting machines, against the corporatization and privatization of our vote and everything else.
Let's get back to accuracy and support the things she's trying to implement. Thank you. We could have time for one, two, three. Okay, make it those three questions. Yes.
Thanks once again for your fine analytical thought. Recently, I heard you briefly on KPFA. And you mentioned the New Hampshire election and said that, if I understood you, that the machines used were the same ones as made by Diebold, although with a different name.
No, yeah, I'm talking about optical, they had optical scans in New Hampshire.
Did you really think that election was...
Well, what we
because
know,
you said that McCain could beat Clinton more easily than beating Obama, and that's why the Republicans won it that way. I was like, woo!
I think that the Republican National Committee and Republican leadership is vastly superior to the Democratic leadership, maybe with the exception of Howard Dean, who's trying to bring some direct, rational, targeted energies and to see what's happening. They go after things. They do things. They know how to attack. And I gave the example of the 88 election where they knocked out Gary Hart, they knocked out Joe Biden, and they brought Dukakis, the only guy who could lose to George Bush Sr., who nobody in America liked really all that much. And they're doing the same now. The strongest candidate, well, they got him, the most radical candidates like Kucinich and Edwards are wiped out. And then Obama, suddenly they got worried in Iowa that he has a lot of popular appeal. He got a lot of the independent vote and younger vote and all that. He's something exciting. Hillary is a candidate that is probably... She could beat a number of the Republican candidates because they're even more miserable as choices. But apparently the polls show that McCain can beat Hillary Clinton, and so they here's what some people say. Who the hell to believe? I don't know, but it's if you take the optical scan machines and you take all the votes of Hillary Clinton and Obama, just take those as one. Universe, the statistical universe, 100%. Hillary gets 52%, 52.75%. Obama gets 40, this is higher math now, 42 points, whatever. He gets the convert, the remaining. And that's the exact flip. So we wonder if they didn't just flip those sums on the, rather they flipped it the other way around. On the paper ballots, Obama leads Hillary by 52-45, and the exact same down to a fraction is what Hillary ends up leading Obama on the optical scans. So the feeling is that there is some kind of subterfuge perpetrated on the optical scans to give her this remarkable lead, because the day before she was 13 points behind and 10 points behind. So I don't know. I mean, I don't think either of them are great prize. I don't think Obama talks about we need new vision, new direction, just content, please, content. That's another whole talk. That's part of it. If I ever write this, the thing I wrote now, it could make a little book about how to think about politics, not just what to think, but how, the methods. And that's a problem of reducing essence to form, where the process is so focused on that you don't get into the substance of it. And I can give you examples of that, even going back to the comparison between fascism and communism, where they're supposedly identical, they're totalitarian twins. Yeah, right. Because of certain similarities in mass mobilizations and all that sort of thing. So that's reducing essence to form. And in elections, you see, it's all process, it's all... it's all horse race. We can't really get the substance of the issues. There's really no democratic discourse or debate or critical investigation. Yeah, Elazar.
Yeah, I like your systemic analysis. I'd like you to try it.
Well, wait, let me just say, did my answer make sense?
It was very interesting, but I wasn't sure if you felt that the machine result was skewed in New Hampshire.
Well, it turns out they didn't use touch screens. They had optical scans. There's something funny about the results. And Dennis Kucinich has asked for a recount. See, this recount and paper trail stuff, it's tricky. Because you got touch screens, you do a recount, you get the same cooked results that you had before. And in most states, you can't get a ballot hand recount unless you lost an election by within 1 or 2 percentage points or so, or less than 2%. So if they do cook the results, you can be out. And then getting a recount, it costs thousands of dollars. In this case, they've got to pay it themselves, I think. It'll be interesting to see what the result will be. Yeah, Elazar.
Okay. So I like your analysis of ballots. For like a century.
My analysis of what?
Your systemic analysis of how power works, and we think it's dumb, but it's very successful. I think the same thing about elections. You've got two parties, both controlled by the capitalist class, the Democrat and Republican, and our model is we're going to vote for the lesser of two evils. That's their model. That's what they want us to think we're doing. We're getting to vote for one of them to control us. And it's been going on for a long time. There is no lesser of evils. Clinton was supposed to be a lesser of evil. And he supposedly betrayed the people with NAFTA, GATT, effective death penalty, anti-terrorist law.
Yugoslavia.
Depleted uranium, on and on and on. So it's a fraud. We need a complete departure and not participate in their rigged game. It's their game. It's their gambling casino. They've set the rules. And anyone that stays in one of their two parties cannot serve us.
There's that view. People always say, we need a real third party. And others always say, we need a real second party. Well, you know, I don't know what it is about my old age, but I increasingly can take two contradictory propositions and see the truth of both of them. I mean, everything you say is absolutely correct and well said. On the other hand, it's really not a matter of indifference that one party wants to wipe out Social Security and the other party wants to keep it. And you look over the years, you know, there are reactionaries in there and there are bourgeois liberals. And that's the game they play. So we're caught on that sort of thing, and it can make life saving differences for people as to whether or not they have a safe legal abortion or they got to go get a kitchen table job again. I mean, you know, there are women who die from this. So there are always these intermediate and limited issues, but it can be life or death for people who are going to see their disability funding taken from them. For people who have real serious disabilities, I can tell you it's a serious struggle. So those crumbs off the table, some of them not such crumbs, you know, they involve billions of dollars in these programs. And the reactionaries are furious that they have to even tolerate this. Why do we even have to tolerate this? So there is that struggle too, and sometimes the differences between the two parties do not make a difference. Sometimes the differences are actually a remarkably clever subterfuge, because the more liberal party can sometimes be the more effective, as with NAFTA and all. Most of these guys backed, you know, he got 80% of the mainstream media, Bill Clinton did, support in 1988 to beat George Bush. I said, what is this big switch over to Clinton? Because they knew he could deliver NAFTA through a Democratic Congress, and he did. He cut that Democratic vote right in half, something that George Bush would not have been able to do. George Bush Sr., not on an issue like that. So that's true. But on the other hand, there are differences. There has been such a thing as a New Deal and a Fair Deal and a Great Society and all those things, and that has
made a difference for some people. There has been a struggle. I couldn't have gone to college if it wasn't for these incremental reformers who fought, people whose names I don't even know, who fought for and got free public education at City College of New York that enabled me to go. So these are not matters that can be dismissed with a slogan about how the parties are bad. So now we have to work out what to do about those two positions and how do you hold them both as being true. What does that mean, and what is then the synthesis of that? I'm going to leave that to you, Elazar, because I know you could do it. Okay. Yes. Yeah, I feel that Dennis Kucinich really injected a level of discourse that, I mean, you would never know it, you know. You would never know it. I talked about, he injected a level of discourse that was unmatched by anybody else in terms of progressive critique of policy and such. And Kucinich is not perfect. If you're going to wait for the perfect person in any area of your life, you're going to be alone. That's that. Except for me, I found the perfect person. yes. I talked in San Francisco about the three primaries, which there was the media primary, the money primary, and the voting primary. The voting primary. And how, well, you know, Edwards, for instance, had got battered in the media primary. He didn't get, he really was defeated in that, and he got outspent in the money primary. Kucinich was not battered and not outspent. He was not even in any of those three primaries. They just didn't even allow him in it. And I think that's what happened in Nevada is emblematic of this, where they just simply banned him. He was willing to show up and participate, and he was banned by NBC. So NBC starts deciding for us who we can hear in the political realm or not. But what was your...
I just wondered... I was just curious about your support for him.
Yeah, I was a little annoyed at him for saying on the second round in Iowa his supporters should throw their support to Obama. I don't think I don't think he had any need or right to do that. He shouldn't have done that. well, Elazar wants to talk about Saint-Denis, that Kucinich is one of those people who voted for the proposition to condemn Saint-Denis, which is a mayoralty in northern Paris, I remember, which Saint-Denis took a little street and named it after Mumia Abu-Jamal, and the Congress condemned Saint-Denis for this and in effect supported the people who want to see Mumia murdered, and Kucinich is one of those who supported that proposition, or at least voted for it. I don't think he wasn't one of the sponsors, was he, or anything like that, yeah. Which is very disappointing. But again, that's, it's indicative. Yes.
Yeah,
very good. Leslie, yes.
What do you think is the best way to kick religion back out of politics?
That's my next book. I'm almost finished. I'm writing it right now. I'm writing a book called God and His Demons. I hope I see you all here next year. The thing to do is stop tippy-toeing around religion and recognize it as a very elevating, spiritual, beautiful force for some people, but also a very ugly, horrible, destructive, ferociously homicidal force through much of history, and to divest them of their double standard, which is you cannot offend me. You're offending my faith. You're offending. You can't, that's an offense. You are offending my sacred beliefs. Where did I read that? I read this in the Free Thought Journal of a lady at a gathering, and she had a drink in her hand, a little glass of wine or something, and this guy came up
who was a an Islamist, and he says, "Is there alcohol in that drink?" She said, "Well, yeah, I think there is a little." And he started saying, "This is an offense. You are offending my religious beliefs, and how dare you do this? My sacred religious beliefs and all that." Hey, oh, get the hell out of here, you're offended. I mean, my sacred beliefs are offended every day. That's called free speech, you see. That's the First Amendment is there to protect the offensive speech, not the inoffensive. Inoffensive speech doesn't need protection. Inoffensive speech doesn't need democracy. If you get up and you say, "I love my mother, I love God, I love my family," that doesn't need any protection. You need some help, maybe, but... what needs protection is the people who get up and say, I don't believe that, I don't like that, so forth and so on. So I'm writing about that. So if you can wait until the book is written. But other than that, I don't know what to do, you know. It's intellectual response. Problem? Oh, I'll write a book. Thank you very much.